Insurance Pool Governing Board. And Mr. Britton, would you provide us with an overview?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I do that, if it's okay with you, I have some things to hand out. Would that be all right?
That's fine.
Okay. First, a couple of things related to the Department of Human Services. This is a document entitled Health Professional Shortage Areas in Oregon, provided by the Office of Public Health Officer. And I will hand that out shortly. Also have from the Office of Multicultural Health a short document entitled Multicultural Health, How Oregon Compares to Other States. And I will hand that out. We also have a summary of Senate Bill 18 and the Department's position, Department of Human Services position on Senate Bill 18. And finally, the letter that was read to Senators Margaret Carter and Frank Shields that was read into the record on Thursday. So I'll hand that out in a moment as well. Now, with respect to the Insurance Pool Governing Board, you should have before you a copy of House Bill 5031. You should also have two books. One is a Insurance Pool Governing Board budget presentation, and it's the document that Mr. King will be working from this afternoon, and another detailed budget book on the Insurance Pool Governing Board as well. But we'll be working from the presentation book. With that, I would call your attention to a memo from me to all of you that was handed out this morning. If you didn't bring your copy, I have extra copies. Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Gordon, you okay? All right.
The senators are on task.
Great. I would start out by referring you to the third page, the large print, the Insurance Pool Governing Board. Its overall purpose: to increase access to private health insurance. They have two programs, marketing information and outreach, and I've labeled it as the central source for employers concerning health insurance information and resources. In this budget, it's about 581,000 total funds, two full-time equivalents. It's in
the other one?
It's
in the
this memo.
Oh, beg your pardon.
And the program that is dominant to the Insurance Pool Governing Board, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, or FEOP, and it provides premium subsidies, health insurance premium subsidies, to low-income families and individuals. About 58.5 million total funds, about 20 million general fund, 44.5 full-time equivalents. The next page, revenue for the Insurance Pool Governing Board General Fund, and I've noted here that it's used in the governor's 2003-05 budget to replace tobacco settlement funds, which are no longer available because they've been not obligated, but let's say committed to the payment of bonds that have been used to balance the state's budget. Other funds, a modest amount of fees from agent training and reimbursements for shared staff, but the lion's share of other funds are federal Children's Health Insurance Program and Medicaid. They are other fund revenue because they come from the Department of Human Services and are spent as other funds within the Insurance Pool Governing Board's budget. And finally, I make note of an ending balance of approximately $725,000 that may come into play with respect to this agency's budget at some point. Budget drivers for the Insurance Pool Governing Board: the resource level established by the Legislative Assembly and governor cap expenditures. This is not an entitlement program, even though the program does receive Medicaid funds. Premium costs are certainly a budget driver. If premiums go up significantly, as they have been, it means that fewer people can be served. And also, I've noted that there is a maintenance of effort requirement under the Oregon Health Plan 2 waiver. Oregon must spend at least $40.9 million over the next 5 years. The governor's balanced budget provides $16.4 million of this maintenance of effort. With that, I'm flipping back to the first page of my memo. There was one budget note from the 2001 regular session. The subcommittee directed the agency to report to the emergency board at its spring 2002 meeting concerning the status of the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program as part of the Oregon Health Plan federal waiver request and on potential subsidy changes and other adjustments to the program that might allow for expanded services. That report was provided to the emergency board along with the waiver request, and the emergency board subsequently approved the submission of that waiver to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Significant policy or oversight issues. Again, the most significant policy issue was the development of the Oregon Health Plan 2 waiver. The OHP 2 waiver involved numerous stakeholders, a waiver advisory steering committee, a leadership commission on healthcare costs and trends, and the emergency board. And overall, the goal, one of the goals of the OHP 2 waiver was to get federal match for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, and we succeeded at that with that goal. The last paragraph under that section, in addition to approving the OHP 2 waiver application, the emergency board approved subsequent limitation, position, and FTE changes after the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services approved the waiver. Also, the emergency board increased the agency's other funds limitation by $74,000 in April 2002 and directed the agency to report to the 2003 Legislative Assembly during its budget hearings concerning the efficacy of funding more of the agency's general fund expenditures with fees or contributions. Finally, relevant issues, trends, or special challenges. Again, the primary funding source of tobacco settlement in the current biennium, 2001-03, is shifted in the governor's budget to general fund. The second bullet, the OHP 2 waiver established a maintenance of effort requirement. Again, $16.4 million of the general fund in this budget are counted toward that five-year maintenance of effort. Third bullet, given the governor's budget resource level for the Medicaid portion of the Oregon Health Plan, it appears that OHP standard population would not be covered after June 30, 2003. If Oregon no longer covers the OHP standard population, what role should the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program play? Put a bit differently, is it appropriate to subsidize health care costs for working persons who earn 170% of the federal poverty level while eliminating health care services under Medicaid to those at 75% of the federal poverty level? And the answer to that question will vary depending on policy goals. On the one hand, the state may want to cover those with the least income, reasoning that they are the most vulnerable. On the other hand, commercial group coverage attainable through FEOP subsidies is less expensive than Medicaid coverage and probably provides better access to enrollees. Consequently, the same resource level could be used to cover more persons. And this is a pretty fundamental policy issue with respect to this budget. The final bullet, given the uncertainty surrounding the state budget, some employers may be adopting a wait-and-see attitude about FEOP and group health insurance coverage. They may be reluctant to sign up for the group medical coverage and FEOP until they know that the program has funding for the 2003-05 biennium. And with that, Madam Chair, I would turn it back to you.
With that, Rocky, I heard Bill Shami, in fact, I think it was on a TV, it had to be TV, where he was in making an appeal to individuals to call and sign up for FEOP. What's been did that just start? Has it been online for some time?
I saw that too.
Yeah, Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board. One of the programs, and I was going to talk about it later, but I'll just let you know about it now. 1993, Senator Walden, was it Representative Walden at that point, I believe? Excuse me. Representative Walden set up an arrangement with the Oregon Broadcasters Association where for a very modest fee, and in those days it was about $10,000, they would give us what's called non-commercial sustaining ad time. And that is not public service announcement time, but if they had a 30-second spot in the middle of the Super Bowl that went unsold, that's what they call a non-commercial time that they just, it's open inventory, not public service announcements. And so for a $10,000 donation, they would give us between $80,000 and $100,000 worth of airtime. Again, not the 2 o'clock in the morning, but the real good stuff that went unsold. And we've been running those for a number of years directed towards small businesses. With the expansion of the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, we decided to do an ad that directly related to that, and Bill Shonley donated a day of his time to come down in the Capitol and do an ad for us, and that is directed towards primarily group coverage. It talks to, he speaks about those who work for employers that provide health insurance. Individuals are unable to obtain or pay their share of the premium primarily for dependent coverage to call FEOP. I can tell you that our average inquiries into our program when we started running that were probably 700, 800, 900 per month, and our average phone calls for the last 3 months have been running between 1,500 and 1,900 per month. And I would say half of that increase has been due to both the radio and the television ads that Mr. Shonley has been doing for us. So it's been a very successful program. Since 1993, we use it a lot for small businesses, especially on the radio, where small businesses that are uninsured are interested in obtaining insurance. They can call us, and we can refer them and connect them up with someone in their local community.
Thank you. I did forget, and I probably should take care of my housekeeping duties before we go any further, because this is the first time that Mr. King has been before this group. But a couple things, if there's anyone who hasn't been to this committee before, we do have a couple of individuals who are sitting in front, Rosie and Rosette, and they are there to, in some respects, to encourage the use of acronyms, although I discourage it, but when you use it, you pay. The funds from Rosie and Rosette at the end of session will go to the Oregon Food Bank in order to feed the hungry in our state. And also, if there's anyone in the audience who happens to have a cell phone on you, please turn it off so it doesn't disrupt the proceedings. So with that, Rocky, and you probably have remembered all of those alphabets and acronyms that we used to use when we were together in Children's Services Division.
Madam Chair, the one thing I want to comment is why is the, I should say, overweight pig on my side and the skinny one on George's side? I'm not sure, but...
Well, I'll let you come to your own conclusions.
Okay, thank you. Members of the committee, I would like to start, and I'll use the book as an outline, and it is the Insurance Pool Governing Board Subcommittee presentation book, and I will be starting with Section 2, which is the agency overview, and primarily on page 2. And I just want to kind of give you a kind of picture of what's going on in Oregon around health insurance. I'm not sure how much you had from the Department of Human Services in their presentation. But as you all know, we have rising insurance premiums. Insurance carriers are leaving different market areas. If you're in Southern Oregon and you need a managed care organization, it's hard to find one. They have closed up shop and moved north because of many of the economic factors. We have regulatory complexity. If you've had anybody from the insurance division try to explain to you as a small business person, for example, what your options are and what the rules and regulations are under obtaining health insurance, they become 10 times more complex over the last 7 or 8 years. We have the Oregon's rate of uninsurance, which we've seen started in the 18% to 20% at the beginning of the biennium, moved down to as low as approximately 11%, and is edging back up to about 14%. And to speak to that, we have evidence that both employer coverage and individual market coverage is starting to slow down and drop down from our highs that we saw during 1998 and 99. The economic growth rate is either at a minus or even at best. The state's fiscal situation, changing demographics as all of us grow a little bit older. We have the complexity of the federal Medicaid waivers that now impact the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, but also make it very complex to figure out what kind of programs, what kind of assistance to get from the federal government, because they are expanding the ways that they can assist the states also. Then we also have the ongoing community partnership challenges. There are more community partners. There are more community partners that have their hands out who also need our assistance rather than us going to them for assistance because of all the economic factors they face. In the year 2000, we had 422,000 uninsured Oregonians. That figure in the year 2002 is at 471,000. Those figures aren't official yet. They'll be coming out over the next month from the Office of Health Planning, Policy, and Research. So we've seen almost 50,000 additional people become uninsured in the state between 2000 and 2002. And I dare say that that figure may be even higher given the drops in group coverage and individual coverage we've seen over the last year reported to the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the insurance division. If you add to that 471,000 for the year 2002, another 100 to 150,000 that are currently on OHP, Oregon Health Plan Standard, and Oregon Health Plan Children's Program, you could add that together and come up with close to 600,000 potential Oregonians that don't have health insurance by the end of 2003. That's out of a 3.5 million population. So despite all the efforts we've had over a number of years, we really see that the economic times are making it tough for families to survive and be able to afford health insurance. That on page three, I give two charts. They're kind of interesting. A lot of people want to know who covers who in terms of Oregon's population. And the top chart is really a percentage of all Oregonians, about the 3.4 to 3.5 million. Approximately 60% obtain their coverage through the private sector. We have about a 14% uninsurance rate. Medicare covers about 14%, and Medicaid, Oregon Health Plan, has about 13%. The bottom chart is just of those that have coverage. You have approximately 69 to 70% are covered by the private sector. Medicare is 16%, and Medicaid is 15%. That becomes somewhat important philosophically, I guess, because when we talk about the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, it really is trying to bridge the gap between the public and private sectors and build on the resources of the public sector, that is the federal dollars and the tax dollars that go into the program, but helping people really receive that service on the private sector side. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. On page four, I go into a little bit about the agency missions, goals, visions, and values. And the agency mission really is to try to get more people insured, whether it's individual coverage, group coverage, whether it's Medicaid, whether it's Medicare. We serve really as a resource in some ways, by subsidizing, in some ways by providing information, in some ways by just giving a phone number. We provide, we hope, just a central location that people can come to, and we can kind of put them out into the spider web to try to find a place that they fit. There are three programs that we manage, and they really are referred to as the private sector components of the Oregon Health Plan. The first, the Insurance Pool Governing Board statutory mission, which relates to the marketing information and outreach. Again, we do agent referrals and a variety of things I'll talk about. Our real mission, though, is to help small businesses the best we can to hook up with a health insurance resource that they can cover the owner and their employees and dependents in that coverage. The second area that we focus on is the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. I will refer to that as FEOP occasionally, primarily not because we use an acronym, but we're trying to brand that name throughout the business community. We don't call it Family Health Insurance Assistance Program when we talk to business folks and a lot of our clients because of some branding that we're trying to do around marketing. But it's private. Our primary mission really is to help people that under 200% of poverty and currently 185 with the federal waivers afford health insurance and subsidize that health insurance either in the group market or individual market. Going back to 1990, we are tied together with the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which is the state's high-risk health insurance pool that is administered under the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And through administrative agreement, we jointly manage all three of these programs. So, again, that is part of the private sector component of the Oregon Health Plan. In terms of agency goals, we try to maximize our dollars.
Thank you.
Mr. King, before you leave the agency mission, I wanted to ask for your assistance helping us think through the question that is posed, that was posed by Mr. Britton in the document that he reviewed with us. It's under the heading Relevant Issues, Trends, or Special Challenges. Do you have that document as well? The question, the policy question before us, or one of the policy questions before us, is to determine if it is appropriate, and I'm reading from Mr. Britton's statement, is it appropriate, for example, to subsidize health care costs for working persons who earn 170% of the federal poverty level through the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, while eliminating health care services under Medicaid to those at 75% of the federal poverty level? And then he goes on to say that the answer to the question will vary depending on policy goals. You have a very definitive mission statement here, and I'm wondering if you can provide us with some guidance and direction as we tackle that question.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, let me kind of deviate a little bit from the presentation because I think that is a central issue that this committee and the legislature as a whole is going to have to grapple with. First of all, let me talk to you about the population we serve, and we get into some details later because when you can't just compare 170% and 75%. We serve people primarily under 185% of poverty. 28% of those are under 100% of the poverty level that are enrolled in the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. The majority of those enrolled are under 125% of the federal poverty level. So the first thing I say is that we have a whole strata of folks between 185 all the way down to 10% of the poverty level. Like Oregon Health Plan Medicaid, we serve self-employed who very often lose money and have very, very little disposable income. So I'm not sure that sometimes the populations in terms of the poverty level, they're much closer in some respects than what people think. The second is I want to point out that for those people in the group market, 50% are children. So very often when we talk about the most vulnerable in our group market, 50% are children. In our individual market, approximately 35% are children. So again, we talk about which are the most vulnerable. Of the non-children in the individual market, approximately 30% of our enrollment are 50-year-old, 70% of them female with chronic health conditions that are enrolled in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the state's high-risk pool. So approximately 25 to 30% of all of our folks that are enrolled in our program are people with significant health conditions. Now, the policy question is it vulnerable based on federal poverty level? Is it vulnerability based on health conditions? I think that's a real tough one. When I talk to somebody with multiple sclerosis but is working and trying to earn a living but doesn't have access to health insurance, if they're at 130% of the poverty level, somebody at 75 who maybe doesn't have multiple sclerosis but has a mental health issue, I don't know how to pick between those, and I think that's a tough question. When I was talking to Mr. Britton earlier today about this, I said from a fiscal standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to put people into the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program on the group side. It's cheap coverage, $89, or an average of $90 per month per member. You can put a lot of folks there. From a social policy perspective, I'm not sure that's accurate, because you do have people who have some severe mental health issues or chemical dependency or physical conditions that preclude them working, and they're under 100% of poverty level. So while you can get the best bang for your buck above using the group market, you may have a whole host of folks that are below that poverty level that have greater needs. I can't give you a definitive answer. I will tell you that these are folks between, you know, 185 down to, we'll say, 75% of the poverty level. And if you're working full-time at $96.90 an hour, you know, you're above 100% of poverty. But generally, these are folks that are working full-time. They're paying taxes. And one of the debates in 1997 when they started this program was equity of health care financing. The people that pay the taxes to support Medicare, Medicaid, business deductions for health insurance, yet they themselves can't afford that same health insurance. So without this program, what we're asking many of these folks, and remember about 20 to 25% of them come off of OHP Medicaid into our program, what we're asking them is reduce your income, you can get health insurance. I don't have an answer. I think it is the toughest question that the governor and the legislature and you at Ways and Means have to answer.
If I may follow up, Madam Chair,
Senator Gordon,
just for a clarification, in trying to get at the answer, did I hear you say that 50% of the people in the group market are children?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordo, that is correct. And if you turn to page, I believe it is 25, and I can go through these statistics a little bit, and kind of skipping around, but I'd rather get to the questions that are important to you. If you'll notice, the little arrow in the middle, first of all, talks about the subsidy level, the employee premium share, the subsidy per month, the member contribution, and the employer contribution. And this is for the group market. It's about $90 a month when you include self-insured and COBRA and portability. If you look down at the bottom, you'll see the group market by age. 48% are children. And in terms of male and female, you're talking about even, about 50-50.
Okay. Madam Chair, I don't want to get ahead of Mr. King's presentation, but perhaps an approach to answering the question would be to ask the question, which strategy reaches the most children? Which strategy covers the most children?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I think that there's no question that OHP Medicaid has approximately 20,000 enrolled in the Children's Health Insurance Program. I'm not sure how many have Medicaid Plus underneath 133% of poverty. But you have to remember that in Medicaid, there are no premiums, no copays, no deductibles, and dental benefits for children, whereas for our programs, there generally are copays, deductibles, some premium, and unless you work for an employer where they provide the dental coverage, there is no dental coverage. I'll also add that almost everyone, without exception, of the children enrolled in our program, our parents could, at their option, place them in Medicaid and have chosen not to do so. One of the primary reasons for this we hear is two things. One, a 12-month eligibility. When you get into group coverage especially, having stability of 12 months, and I'll talk about that in a little while, is very important to these families because 50 cents an hour up or working two holidays, one period, can throw them in and out of coverage, so they like the stability. The second is provider access. These folks carry an ODS, a Pacific Care, a Kaiser, a Blue Cross card. They don't have the access issues that we often hear about under OHP Medicaid. They're not discriminated against in any way. They have the same doctor panels that you and I have through our health plans.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, going back to page 5, I believe, where I talk a little bit about the agency goals in terms of maximizing the dollars, expand our participation and representation in minority population. I'll show you some statistics that show anywhere from 14% to 16% of our enrollment is minority or unreported. 2% of that is unreported. And while that may be an acceptable figure when one looks at the total population, it is not acceptable when one looks at the vulnerable population. That is, the uninsurance rate of the minority populations are much higher. So you can't just do it on a percentage of the population. You have to look at the percentage of uninsured population. We don't think we are at our goals, and we need to do a better job, especially around the high risk pool in that area. So 15, 14, 16% fine on the face. It's not fine when you look at the number of uninsured folks in the minority population. We want to reduce our administrative costs. One of the most difficult things we've had because of the up and down of our budget and the people we serve is a high administrative cost. When you only serve 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 folks, it's hard to have a 5% or 10% administrative cost. So we hope as we build the program that we're able to maintain and get back to our original objective, which is to have a total administrative cost under 10%. We want to incorporate more internet and other technologies to facilitate and expand our customer services. When I first started with this program in 97 and we held some of the community meetings, you had maybe a quarter of the audience that raised their hand that had access to internet. Now you generally have a half to two-thirds that raise their hand. And this is of the low-income population. So we want to do a better job in that area. And finally, we have a role that we think we play in terms of some of the policy decisions that are made by the legislature and the governor around health care because of what we see as a very well-grounded private sector knowledge of all the different programs and resources available. Our agency vision kind of ties all those together, and we have very much the same agency values, I think, that you've probably seen in a lot of the different presentations. I will tell you that going from 10 or 12 employees to 60 employees and maintaining agency values and communication and relationships and the same kind of standards around customer service has been a very difficult challenge over the last couple of years. On page 6, you can see kind of how we're organized. We have the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, again, a part of Department of Consumer and Business Services, the Insurance Pool Governing Board, which has both the marketing information and outreach functions, as well as the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. And those functions are laid out on page 7 with, again, FEOP. I call it FEOP, knowing it's an acronym. I'll pay up at the end, Madam Chair. The Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. And again, that's through interagency agreement since 1990 when we first started these programs. Customer service, marketing, and outreach. I cannot tell you the number of phone calls that our office has received in the last 4 months as all the questions around the future of FEOP, of OHP Standard, of OHP Plus, the Medical Needy Program, one of the largest enrollments we've seen in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool is people coming from the Medical Needy Program and from OHP Standard, and all the confusion around those programs as people scramble to find coverage just in case they lost that either in the last budget cut they were going to do or on June 30. We do a lot of training. We'll talk about that of agents, administrative and fiscal, healthcare policy coordination, and finally the certified small business plans, which I'll talk about in a little bit more detail.
Rocky, based on the confusion and the cuts and what was taking place, have you seen an increase in FIAP?
Madam Chair, we are not open really in the individual side of FIAP.
So this group.
But in group, we've seen a lot of increase in group. Group is about 30% of our enrollment. Of the 1,600 people or 1,700 that we currently have approved that have not enrolled, probably about 35% of those are group. We have seen a lot of inquiries and a lot of people get on the reservation list. For the individual side, we have a reservation list of about 10,000. I only got probably about 1,000 openings between now and the end of the next biennium out of those 10,000 that I'll be able to serve. On the group market side, there are no reservations. If someone has group coverage available to them, they can get in. So the short answer to your question is a lot of inquiries, people getting on the reservation list. We've seen growth in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, both with subsidies and without subsidies, of people that have left OHP and are trying to find coverage today.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. Is it feasible that the state of Oregon is subsidizing small businesses who are choosing to purchase the Cadillac health insurance plans, knowing that they're going to be able to get assistance?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, first of all, almost everyone that's enrolled in the family health insurance program through group coverage is in a program or in a group that already had existing coverage, where the employer was paying for either all or a good portion of that for the employee, but was paying a small portion for the dependents. Mm-hmm. So you're not talking about, first of all, companies that just started doing this only because the subsidy was available to the low-income workers. The second is that when you purchase group coverage, you have to buy it for everybody. You can't say, I'm buying it for the too poor but not the too rich, or I'm buying it for the too rich, not the poor. So they've got to make it available to everybody. The majority of people that come into FIAP are generally spouses and the children, or in some cases where there was a low contribution on the part of employer in a very small business, say 50%, will help with the employee and also the dependents. No employer that we know of has ever reduced any contribution level for to an employee or to the dependents because of the FIAP program, primarily because it's illegal to lower the contribution for one and not everyone. In other words, I can't say all of you make money, I'm going to keep your contribution, but because you are on FIAP, I'm going to lower my contribution because we can get state money. Illegal. They have to do it for everybody the same. Second is, there aren't a lot of Cadillac plans available. Our average deductible when we get to the statistics for the Blue Cross plans is $500 a month. And that's for the individual market. For the group market, the benchmark plan, that is what most Oregon small businesses are providing right now, is a $500 deductible plan. Do we provide Kaiser, HMO Oregon? Yep. And we want people to be in managed care and have what may be referred to as a Cadillac plan, an HMO product. But that's okay because they're generally less expensive than a $500 deductible plan. So these are folks that are working for Walmart. These are folks that are working for Monarch. Just read in the news. The ones Oldfield. That just mm-hmm. Yes. They're working for hairdressers, that are working for doctor's offices, that are working at the local pizza parlor. These aren't people that are in these Hewlett-Packard style, best plan in the world kind of programs.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, Madam Chair, on page 8, which gives you who our board is, and I want to point out to the chair that Glenn Knickerbocker is still chair of our board, and again, someone that goes way back with state programs back into the 70s. The first organizational chart is on page 9, shows the 7 Oregon Medical Insurance Pool employees, the 2 marketing outreach and information, and the 45 FIAP employees. And we also, at the October e-board, made a request and got approval for 17 additional positions. And through all the budget process and the e-boards and the lateness of that, they did not get into our budgets, governor's budget, balanced budget request. We're going to ask for a technical adjustment to add those 17 positions, not the dollars tied to them. Our sense is that if we get those positions, it's our responsibility to find out the efficiencies and the mixtures and the matches to fund those program or fund those positions ourselves. I should say that it would be our intent not to fill all those 17, but depending on what comes out of the budget process, we'll try to utilize the most appropriate positions of those. On page 11 is our IPGB's strategic business plan. We're really focused on customer service. When you are getting right after Christmas, 2,000 calls a week at one point, and you've only got four people manning the phones, it is real tough to provide the kind of quality government service that that we all, I think, would like to see. We've added to some of the staff there. The phones have come back a little bit to averaging about 1,600 calls a week. Some of those calls are a minute. They're an internal transfer. Some of those calls are a half hour because somebody's dying, and we need to time into somebody that can talk to him and walk him through a process, and you get everything between that.
Rocky, I want to go back a little on the 17 positions that were authorized, and they were authorized with the goal in mind that we would be implementing the Learning Health Plan 2 and that whole expansion. And what's your best guesstimate now that we're... We don't have the same kind of resources of what your needs will be in expanding FEA.
Madam Chair, let me, of the 45 positions that we originally had for FEA, we've hired 43 of those and left two vacant. Of those 17 positions that were approved at the October-November e-board, we've hired five of those positions and left 12 vacant. So we really only hired three of those additional 17. We hired, for example, a lower-level administrative assistant position in the 17 and didn't hire a higher eligibility specialist position. We hired a phone person in the 17 rather than another position in the 45. Our sense is that we are going to have probably 12 vacancies of those 17 unless there is some additional expansion.
But my question is, are you anticipating additional expansion?
I'm not anticipating additional expansion over what the governor's balanced budget is, and as we all know, that there's going to be another governor's budget coming out at the end of this week, and we're going to have to wait and see what he proposes there and what policy decisions the legislature makes. But my sense is that given the state's budget crisis, you're not going to see us go higher than what probably the governor's balanced budget is. What may happen is a mixture or a change in the mixture of priorities. For example, what Senator Gordley talked about, if group is really the best buy, then let's utilize that. But if the individual market subsidizing somebody there while we cut somebody at below 100% doesn't make sense, then we may change our mix a little bit.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Mr. King, can you relate the staffing, the e-board staffing request to the current wait list? You have 9,000 or 10,000 people on that wait list. What is the relationship between those two pieces? And then I have a follow-up question to that.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordon, I'm not sure what you're asking, but the only real relationship is that we've had to hire some additional phone staff to handle the calls of people coming onto the waiting list. And very often when somebody gets on that reservation list, we try to push them in another direction if we know. For example, if we think they may be eligible for Oregon Health Plan or the children's program through OHP, we'll make a direct referral at that point. And in all the materials we send out to them when they get on the reservation list, we try to lay out several different options for them. So I'm not sure that the staff really have a lot to do other than some of the customer service piece to the reservation list.
Well, follow up, Madam Chair. The initial request was for 17, and I was just trying to understand whether that staff complement would have helped service the reservation list.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, no. Okay. The reservation list is tied to the fact that I can serve 4,000 people in the individual market and 11,000 approximately in the group market. House Bill 2519 requires, and that's the waiver bill, requires that I be at about a 50-50 state resource between group and individual. That's dollars, not people. And because group is so much less expensive, I can serve 11,000 versus 4,000. I'm at about 3,000 in individual. I'm at about 1,250 or about 1,300 in group today. So I can come up in group, you know, approximately 14,000. I've got another 800 that are approved in the individual market, which almost takes me to my max on the individual market for the next biennium. So the staffing, the decision not to hire the people relates to there's no sense bringing people on until we know the future direction of the program, number one. And number two is I want to bring as few people on as I can because every dollar I save in administrative cost, I can put into the program and people I serve.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for helping me work through my confusion here. Just one last question. What do you tell people who are on the reservation list? You have 9,000 people. Realistically, you're not going to be able to get to those folks in any short span of time. So what do you tell them?
Madam Chair, Representative Gordley, about 5,000 of those I think will have an opportunity to fill some of the individual market slots that we have coming up. And the reason for that is every month we lose 100 to 200 people through the redetermination process. People either dropping below and go into OHP Medicaid, people who earn too much and go off, or people who find other coverage, for example, move from the individual to group coverage where maybe they get their premium. So we lose 100 to 200 people every month. I've got that additional 1,000 folks that I can put on over this next year. The people that probably won't be touching the program are those that have got on the reservation list in the last 5 or 6 months. And we basically tell them, as we have all along, that the wait is perhaps going to be over a year before. So we try to tell them that there's little hope. And by the way, that's why we do a reservation list. In the group market, I've got openings. You call up, you got an application. We go meet with an employer, we leave 20 applications. Go meet with an agent, leave applications, because I have openings today. With a reservation list, what we didn't want to have people do is to go through the process, filling out an application, gathering the materials, send it in, and then to have us say, whoops, you got to wait 6 months, and then have to do it again. So we've done it on a reservation. Now, that causes some problems in that there are many people on the reservation list that probably could be found and may be found to be ineligible. By the time their name comes up, they have, even though you explain the assets and the income, you don't know what time of the year. Maybe it's a seasonal worker and their opening comes up right when they have the most income. There are a variety of reasons, but people, just because they're on the reservation list, doesn't mean they're eligible.
I won't belabor this. Please continue.
Okay.
Please continue. I had a quick question, Chair.
Madam Vice Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Gordon. Just a quick Family Health Insurance Assistant Program 101 question. But when, and you used the term subsidy, so I'll use that. When the check for the subsidy is issued, who's the check issued to?
Madam Vice Chair, I assume that's Vice Chair, Representative Smith. Okay, let me turn to, can you hold that question for a few minutes? Because I'll go through that whole process with you in about 3 pages.
And, you bet.
Okay, I'll do that. Let me turn back to page 13, Program Principles. I'm skipping a little bit, but kind of get through. I know that we have a lot of questions around that. I think it's important to talk about the program principles. When we put this program together in 1997, we worked with some legislators, Representative Patty Milne, the governor's office, and we said that whatever we did, we had to do around some set of principles that both the legislature and us as program operators were there. So I want to go through those real quick. Fostering independence and self-reliance. We really wanted to make this a simple subsidy to help people really be on their own as opposed to dependent on the state for a variety of different things. We wanted people to have choices, the same kinds of choices that you and I had. We wanted them to respect confidentiality and maintain personal dignity. When somebody walks in to their provider, they don't know they're on FEOP. They have the Blue Cross card. They have the OMIP card. They have the Pacific Care card, the ODS card. It was really something that was important to both the legislature and those of us that put some of the concepts forward. We wanted to assure administrative simplicity and efficiency, and if there's anyone that we haven't met, it's that one. I will tell you that it is not administratively simple. Our costs administratively are still high. And we're not the most efficient at this point, partly because we go up in population, down. We don't know what tomorrow is, and it's very hard to get settled on an internal system that from one month to the next month is the same, and that's one of our big things. It's not an entitlement. That was very important to the legislature. We can stop taking new enrollments. Responds to real-life issues of maintaining a household budget. There's very little change in disposable income between 100 and 150% of the federal poverty level. As you move up, also many of the support services go away and you lose. So we wanted to make sure that the subsidies were reasonable. Builds on the strengths of the current system. We wanted to make sure we got to the uninsured, that people didn't drop coverage and just come to us. We wanted to make sure that you had to insure your children before you could insure your adults. And finally, to promote equity in health care financing. Again, those are the folks that pay the taxes that are out there working to support those in Medicaid, Medicare, and small business health insurance deductions, yet they themselves couldn't afford coverage. And that was a key principle that the legislature debated in 1997. Now, our history started in 97, House Bill 2594 targets the low income below 185% of the federal poverty level. We try to remove the economic barrier of providing health insurance by paying a substantial portion of the premium. We wanted to use the private sector system that provided better access and no stigma. Again, emphasize coverage for children. One of the things I want to point out is when we started, we thought we were going to serve 15,000 folks. We got up to about 65 to 7,000, and the next governor's budget said you're going to serve 5,000 folks. So we had to close intake and go way down for about 6 or 7 months. We got through, but because we started the biennium at 6,500, we had to drop all the way down close to 4,000. Got approved for 4,500, came back up, and got to about 5,000 to even the biennium, and then they got cut in 2001 by another $2 million. We started the biennium too high and had to come down to almost 2,700 enrollments before the federal waiver, and now we're back up to about 4,300 enrollments plus another 1,700 that have been approved that are out there finding health insurance. And it's that roller coaster from one biennium to the next that's been the most difficult for us to manage from a staffing standpoint, administrative standpoint, and also from a communication standpoint to those on the reservation list. But we, I think, have met that challenge as best we could.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. Rocky, are we at risk for a legal challenge if you have two candidates, one that just happened to have the luck of the draw being early in, receives coverage? It's identical circumstances, someone on the reservation list, no coverage.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, you can always be sued, you know, but no one has. I will tell you that the legislature was involved in the debate that we had about the reservation list. A variety of different advocacy groups, the Oregon Health Council, the Insurance Pool Governing Board, the Governor's Office, the Emergency Board at one point, I believe, when we talked about this. And I will tell you that everybody wanted somebody to have the ticket to the front of the line. And I can make an argument myself for a whole variety of folks that ought to have that ticket. But when it came to nightfall, it was that no one could agree on that, who should have that ticket, who the same person was. Out of that came just a sense of it had to be the first come, first serve. Now, I can't tell you if somebody at 105% of poverty who is in good health has more vulnerability or less vulnerability than a child at 180% of poverty. It's very difficult. There's a whole host of folks in the family health insurance program, average age, again, 50, 70% female with chronic health conditions. On the other side, I have a lot of healthy folks under 100% of poverty that are enrolled in it. So the answer to that is no one could come up with what was the most equitable and agreeable priority process. So we have settled on first come, first serve. We have not been served any kind of suit. And I will tell you that it's very difficult for our phone folks to deal with when somebody calls up and they're in medical emergencies. And to say wait in line, it's very tough. We just don't say wait in line, by the way. We try to, if they're in Multnomah County, there's some great clinics. If they're in Eastern Oregon, one of the things we try to do is refer them to a variety of different health resources if they're in emergencies.
Well, thank you. Could we manage the Oregon Health Plan this way?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I do not believe you can do that under the mandatory population because you're required to maintain an open enrollment. On the standard population, in fact, it is set up that way. The legislation allows to go up to, I think, 185%. Governor Kitzhaber's original budget, I think, was about 110%, and I'm not sure you can probably answer where the governor's...
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, my understanding is that under the federal waivers, the newest Oregon Health Plan waivers, we do have the ability to cap the program. There is some discussion for the new eligible population or the expansion population. Those people who are categorically eligible, they have an entitlement. If you meet those criteria, you are aged or disabled, you can get into the system if you fall within those categorical eligibles. For those other folks, we have the potential to cap the program. There's some dispute, quite frankly, as to whether or not state law creates an entitlement for those people if they're below 100% of the federal poverty level. But under the federal law, we do have some ability to cap the program.
I was suggesting that, by the way. I just wondered, it just seems to me we've got a little vulnerability in this at some point in time, but that'll... remain to be seen.
Over the years, depending upon the language in particular, both federal law or state law, there is some vulnerability when you talk about social services, or we would not have been sued in several areas that will come before this committee, and that what we've had to respond to over time. You have the Staley, for example, which is one that talks about service to the developmentally disabled population. You have had the juvenile rights, which had to do with the service delivery and what's available in the child welfare field. So these are always there that you look at. And part of it is how we write statutes and what's expected in the statutes and how it's written. And certainly with the federal statute that's covered Medicaid on the eligible, on the categorical population, it's pretty clear as to who is entitled to service. And beyond that, we wanted to serve more than what was mandated by the federal government. But that's always a potential, I think, in everything that we do as a governmental entity. I think the same exists if you're looking at a public safety, for example. The public will often ask, well, how come we have to give legal libraries and what have you? And if you go back and you check, there's been a court decision that says someplace that we must do these kinds of things. So we're always vulnerable.
Okay, Madam Chair, so we can get to, I think, Representative Smith's questions, I want to turn to page 18 and just quickly go over the eligibility and then application and enrollment process. First of all, they must reside in an applicant must reside in Oregon, and that's whether it's 0 days or 10 years. But I will tell you that the majority of folks have been here for a considerable length of time. Must be a U.S. citizen or a qualified non-citizen. Must have been without health insurance for the previous 6 months. Medicaid does not count. So somebody working out or up the economic income ladder, we don't count them coming off of Medicaid as having insurance. Once you get on the reservation list, you can get health insurance because we don't want to discourage people from buying it and finding some way to get it if they can once they're at least on the reservation list. Must have investments and savings less than $10,000. All eligible children in the family must have health insurance before adults can have the subsidy, and that's eligible children. People eligible for or receiving Medicare cannot use the subsidy. That's by statute. And our eligibility is for 12 months. Some of these are a little different than OHP Medicaid. They have a six-month eligibility. We have a 12-month. And again, that is more in cycle with private sector. We also have a higher investment in savings. We're at $10,000, which I believe Medicaid is at $3,000, and for children it is $5,000. And the reason for that is we want people to make more money and move up the economic ladder. One of the questions that always comes to me at these meetings is, if you determine eligibility for 12 months and at the end of 1 month, what if somebody wins the lottery and wins the $1 million? What do you do? And my response is I call them up on the phone, congratulate them, and tell them they'll be paying more in taxes than their subsidy is going to cost them. I'll be frank with you. If every one of our folks got a $5 an hour raise, a better job, could buy a car, save some money, that to me is well worth 12 months of investment to make sure they don't have to worry about health care. We want these folks to earn more money. And what we've tried to say to them is, you got 12 months. And don't worry about this piece. Go out and take care of your family and do the best you can. Work the overtime hours or whatever it is. That adds to the economy. It doesn't subtract from it. Subsidy levels, four of them, up to 125% of the poverty level, 95%, up to 150 from the 125. We're at 90%. And then it starts dropping off more dramatically from 150 to 170. We're at 70% subsidy level. 150 to 170 of the federal poverty level, excuse me, 170 to 185, we're at a 50% subsidy. On page 19, you see the income guidelines. There's also a sheet in there that I've given you at the front, but the average minimum wage is $6.90 an hour. If you're a man or a woman and you have two children and you earn minimum wage, then you will be at a 95% subsidy level. That equates to about $9.17 per hour for a family of three and to qualify for the 95% subsidy level. So you can see the majority of these folks are working. They're making an income. They just can't afford their share of the premium in the group market or their share, the full share of the premium in the individual market. Now I want to get to Representative Smith's question, because the application and subsidy process is very important to understand. In the group market, and that's different than the individual, someone will make application. In that application, they will also provide us with information about their health benefit plan. The federal government requires, as a part of the waiver, that we have a floor of benefits that we're willing to subsidize, and that is a very liberal floor. We've tried to incorporate approximately 95% of all group plans that are offered in this state, primarily by the small businesses. Most large businesses do meet the benchmark plan. So they have to make application. We review that application, excuse me, and if approved, they get a letter saying you've been approved. Now we need an employer verification form, and that employer will send to us what that person's premium is, what their dependent premium is, what the employer's share of the premium is, what the employee's share of that premium. When we receive that, they're set up on the system. The money is deducted from their check. Let's say the premium share for them is $100, and let's say that we're going to subsidize 70%. $100 is deducted from their check. They fax us or mail us a copy of their pay stub. We, in turn, then subsidize them back $70 if they're at their 70% level. Send them a check within 3 business days of receiving that. Now, that's a problem for a lot of low-income families. We used to actually give it prospectively. That is, we knew they were going to get X amount. We would send it to them a week before it was deducted. But we ran into a lot of problems because of the administrative costs, because their hours changed so much in the low-income that 1 month their share is 100, the next month 95, the next month 110, and so we were having to make continual adjustments. So we finally went to just fax us, we'll pay out that subsidy. It's a very clean process. If they stop their coverage and it stops getting taken out, they don't get anything because they don't send us the wage stub that shows it was deducted. We think the error rate is pretty small and that the fraud rate is almost non-existent from that process. And every year, the employer, again, has to verify employment benefit plan, how much is deducted and not deducted from their paychecks. So we're also able to see, getting back to another question that was raised, whether anybody increases or lowers their contribution from an employer to that employee. So nobody can really drop it without really seeing it over a period of time. So the group process works pretty good. It is labor intensive because we do get the faxes. It's all done by hand. There are some employers that are working with us who are actually fronting the money to the employees. And then the employer is emailing or sending us what was paid for by them on behalf of the employee. And this is so that there is no cash kind of withdrawn from the employee who, because of their low income, it's hard to make it from week to week, let alone having to pay your health insurance premium too. Individual markets a little different. When they make application to us, if they're found eligible, we send them a certificate of eligibility that they then can go to a list of approved individual market carriers in the state. And that's important because we've got agreement from about 6 carriers that they don't have to make an upfront premium payment if they have that certificate of eligibility. As you know, if you go out and apply to ODS or Blue Cross or Pacific Care for an individual plan, they're going to say, send me 2 months of premium. These folks can't afford that. So these carriers have agreed that if there's a certificate of eligibility, they will not require upfront premium. If they're enrolled, let's just say they're enrolled in the Kaiser Health Plan. Kaiser, when they have that certificate, they know it's one of our clients. They bill us for the full premium. We pay Kaiser, and we bill the individual for their share of the premium. So if the premium is $200, let's say they're at the 70% level, their share is 60. Kaiser bills us for two. We pay Kaiser their two. And we turn around and bill the client for their share, which is the 60. All of that done is done electronically with the carrier. And that's what's very efficient. We have one person that can handle 1,500 individual or 2,000 individual accounts because it's all done electronically. The other thing that we do that's just a little bit different is we usually get 1 month's premium from the individual ahead so that if they are 10 days late paying their premium, then they've got probably a 30-day grace period before the loss of the subsidy. So we have a little bit more leeway because right up front we have them try the best they can, and some of them make it in payments over the first period of time, build up so they always have 1 month of premiums ahead of time. Now, this is important because in the private market, you don't get 60 days or 90 days or 6 months. You basically have notice, and you have 10 days after that due date, although there is a period of time, I think it's up to 30 days that most carriers give, that you could actually reinstate your insurance. But they cancel your insurance when the premium payment's not there, and we don't want that to happen if somebody's 10 days late. So we always try to work with our accounts to make sure they have a little money in the bank so that when we're paying, they don't lose any coverage. Now, what happens if somebody doesn't pay their share of the premium? Do they lose health insurance? The answer is no. What they lose is the subsidy. When somebody hasn't paid their premium, and we'll know about 30 days in advance before potential loss of the coverage, we notify the carrier that they have become ineligible for the subsidy, and they are now self-pay. So the carrier writes them a letter. We've already written to them twice to say, pay us your premium share or, you know, your subsidy's gone. They fail to respond. The carrier then writes to them that says, you know, you need to pay us now because you no longer have a subsidy. So we're not in the insurance business. We're in the subsidy business. And it's important to know that we don't cancel the insurance. That's really between the individual and the carrier. I don't know, Representative Smith, if that answers your question about how the money works. And
thank you very
much. Okay. On the pages 21, it shows you our weekly calls, and you can see that starting around the beginning of the year, except for primarily Christmas vacation.
On an annual basis, what's your percentage of individuals who drop their subsidy?
Madam Chair, Senator, Madam Chair, may I get back? I have that statistic in a full page, and I don't have it here with me right now. It can tell you the terminations, reasons for terminations for the last, since inception for the program, Kelly, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, we can give that to you since inception of the program. On page 21, it gives you some quick graphs on weekly calls, number of people enrolled in FEOP, and the roller coaster is just related to the fact that every budget year we kind of change our mind on how many people we're going to serve. Our lines are headed up now. It's our intent, until we're told otherwise, to try to fill up to the 15,000 folks that are enrolled or approved in the governor's balanced budget request. On page 22, you see on the top graph is the average premiums for the last 3 years, 2.5 years, and the average subsidy. You see a little spike each January. That traditionally is when carriers raise their premiums. But we really haven't seen double digit. I mean, going from $300 in December 0 or December 2000 to about $350 as a premium, it isn't as much of an increase as I originally thought we would have. That's about a 15-16%. Part of that is we've gone from $300 deductible plans to $500 deductible plans. So in other words, part of the increases are being absorbed by out-of-the-pocket costs of our enrollees as well as all private sector enrollees. Average subsidy that kind of has also kind of remained steady. Page 23 gives you kind of our enrollment. As of the end of the month, last month, we had 4,030. I'm in the subsidy levels. Shows you the children and adults percentage for 50, 70, 90, and 95% subsidy. We started in January at about 2,700, which was right after we received the waiver request. So we've put on about 1,300 in the last 3 months, an additional 1,600 that have been approved that don't show up on these figures until they're actually enrolled in their group or individual plan. And actually, we are at about 4,300 right now that have been enrolled. Our average subsidy is $176.95 per month per person enrolled. These kind of give you all of the markets by market type. Our average age, for example, in the individual market is 37. In the group market, because 48% are children, is a lot lower, about 24, and in both markets, about 33. On the next page, we give you length of enrollment by type of market. For those that have left the program, the average is about a year and a half, about 16 months. For those that are currently enrolled in the program, it's about 22 months.
Question.
Sure.
if you look at the issue of children in your market, and how much does it cost for each child to be add-on to subsidize? You know?
Madam Chair, for the individual market, you're talking about between $100 and $110 per month per child. And that's a little higher than what it should be, but the reason for it is in the individual market, they have what they call compressed rates. If you were to go out and say, what's the actually cost for those kids, it's probably going to be in the $90 range rather than $100, $110. But regulations require about a 3-to-1 ratio, so they have compressed rates, so the younger actually subsidize the older. But that would be about what it would cost. In the group market, you're talking in probably the $70 to $85. Again, it depends on the group. Some charge for children the same as they do for adults. Some have a special employee and children rate as opposed to an employee family rate. But I would say it's between $75 and $85 per child. One of the important pieces is on page 24, and it shows the geographical distribution of enrolled members. One of the big concerns, especially coming from some of the rural communities, was that if we came out with this program, the Portland area, Willamette Valley, were going to eat up 100% of the enrollment. So one of the things that we've always done is try to do as much outreach in some of the rural communities and some of the what we call more minority-focused communities, the Woodburn area, northeast Portland, that the best we can to make sure we've got good distribution of folks. And these figures really matched the state's own insurance rate to some degree in terms of the percentage of people that should be in the program. We're pleased with that distribution, especially when you look at the southern and south coast area. They're very well represented in the program. You also have a higher, lower incomes and a higher group of people on Medicaid in some of the northeast and southeast areas, so it would be reasonable to expect that we'd be a little bit lower there. Ethnic and racial heritage of enrolled members, I've said that again. I like on the face of it this distribution. What I don't like about it is that it really is against the population as opposed to the uninsured population. Hispanic population, for example, has a very, very high uninsurance rate and should be higher than what's represented of here. Again, we represent probably more accurately the private sector representation of minority enrollment. And I don't think that that is necessarily acceptable. And in fact, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool Board put this down as a major area for them to look at as a board, which, again, traditionally follows the private sector. But their sense is we need to work better with the carriers, whether it's Blue Cross, ODS, Kaiser, all the others, to do some joint outreach in the minority communities.
Just an observation, if I look at the groupings, and based on their population numbers in the state, the one that you are doing a good job of enrolling is the Asian Pacific Islander. Senator Shields.
I was just trying to understand better. You said this represents the commercial insurance. Are you saying their patterns are about the same? I didn't understand what you said.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, let me give you an example. The Hispanic community has one of the highest uninsured rates, and my sense is this figure ought to be closer to 10 or 15% enrollment in FEOP as opposed to 5%. But our anecdotal, in discussions we've had with carriers, if you ask them what percentage of enrollment of Hispanic do they have, and they're going to be closer to what FEOP's enrollment is. So our enrollment tends to mirror the private sector enrollment terms of distribution among minorities. And what we need to do is work with the private sector, not so much outreach to the Hispanic community and to the black community and to others and Indian American, but is really to work with the carriers because we have to do joint outreach. OMIP gets the high risk pool. The way you get into that is you're turned down from Blue Cross Blue Shield. OMIP doesn't go out and do outreach with individuals. We get our referrals from private sector carriers. So if we're only getting 5% Hispanic, it's because Blue Cross, and I don't mean to be picking on Blue Cross here, they're just the biggest, but Blue Cross, Kaiser, ODS, whoever, it's they're not getting the applicants from the minority community. So we've got to work closer with the private sector, not just for us to do outreach, but for them also to open up the doors and see if we can get them to do some outreach in both the small business as well as the individual market. I don't know if that makes sense.
Reverend Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. Your presentation's been very good. I appreciate that. An observation I have, and I'm just going to say it really candidly, and again, this is truly with a statement to the group here that this is 101 for me. I'm learning. But when I look at the Mid-Columbia region of 111 folks and Northeast at 112, I just shrug my shoulders. I don't see the significance of this program. 112 people served in Baker, Malheur, Union, and Wallowa. My goodness, that's hardly anyone. And so I guess I'm struggling with needing to know the benefit that we're getting from this. I look at Gillam, Hood River, Morrow, Sherman, Umatilla, Wasco, and Wheeler County. My goodness, you have 170,000 people there, and only 111 are being served. Again, I shrug my shoulders. And your presentation's been very good, but I guess I need some help seeing the significance of this for me in rural Oregon.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, let me put my program advocacy hat on for a moment. For the last 6 years, I could serve between 4,000 and 5,000 people. Now, by your definition, to make it meaningful, I have to put all that 5,000 in Southeast or Northeast or Central. I can't. What I can do is ensure that it's best distributed throughout the state as evenly as I can. I don't control who or when they get on the reservation list.
Yes, I'm not saying that, Madam Chair. I'm saying to me there ought to be more of a focus to targeting groups of folks who truly need this, and I'm sure someone will use this against me someday, but when I look at 37, and I'm using your terms, 37-year-old white guys making up the average and the majority on this, I wonder if that's truly where we ought to be focused. Right? Yeah, and I apologize. I'm not trying to be offensive. It just it hits me as is this truly the focus of where the need is. I'd like to know where focus is.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'd really challenge you on 37-year-old white guys. First of all, 34% of enrollment is children. Secondly, if you look at, for example, on page, I'm going to take you to page 29, and where you've got 74% female, average age 48 years, and I've got over approximately 1,000 enrollment in the Oregon Medical Insurance pool, people with chronic health condition. The other piece, and the advocacy piece, I guess, is when you only have 4,000 or 5,000, remember the largest number of uninsured Oregonians reside in Portland area. They don't reside in Baker. They're in Portland area.
That's what I'm struggling with, Madam Chair.
And what we've tried to do is to make sure that enrollments are distributed throughout the state, and we do that through outreach and making sure that we give as many presentations in Eastern Oregon as we do in Western Oregon.
Again, Manager, I'm not questioning your work. I truly am not. I'm questioning the significance of the program. And you know, we have a lot of federally qualified safety net clinics that are also looking for subsidies. And I'm sitting there wondering, you know, is there a synergy? Is there a way to get a bigger bang for the buck? And I guess I'm just thinking out loud. But when I look at the area I've represented in the past and the area I currently represent, I shrug my shoulders.
As I understand, I know involved in 2519 discussions of last session, it was the policy of the body that they wanted to try to expand the role of FEOP. In order to begin to do a much better job of picking up individuals who, what we term the working poor. Those individuals who are working every day, who can't afford health care, whether that be through an employer group or whether that be through individual. And so until we did 2519, there was some limitation placed upon Rocky's organization in order to try to move forward, if you will. Once we received the federal approval, you know, we were all kind of working with bated breath, and the feds approved that we could use CHIP for match and all these other kinds of good things. And then we had additional budget crisis, which then again said to the agency, you know, sorry guys, but you're not going to go to the level in which we had asked you to go back even at the October 2002 emergency board, because we approved the 17 FTE, the positions, prior to the actual waiver approval, with the notion that this agency was, we were going to get the approval, we were going to have the dollars, and that they could go ahead and begin the expansion. And that has not come to fruition. I just need to put some of this in context. We have two different distinct things going on when we talk about organ health care in Oregon. Actually, there's three, if I take back and look at the picture. We have one, that which is tied to Medicaid and Medicare, that piece, and that's the Oregon Health Plan. When we wanted to take and move it at a much higher, a much greater level than just the categoricals, that's one piece. And we had another piece of it that said, you know, there's a population out there that we know that even if some of them are eligible, will not get insurance, will not go to the Oregon Health Plan. For whatever it's dignity, you have employers who would like to help cover their employees but cannot because of revenue issues. And so Rocky's piece is actually kind of coming in to fill that, bridge that gap. And I guess our public policy will be, do we put more resources in to assist Rocky's group to do more in FEOC to expand that and to expand the subsidy and to work more with group and individuals, or do we not? And that's a policy discussion that this body, I mean, Senator Gordley asked the question earlier, I think, before others came in, because if you'll turn to the front, one of the questions that's raised by our legislative fiscal staff, Mr. Britton, and he really raises that question for us. That says in the front of the LFO's document, where he talks about relevant issues, are the special challenges that we as a body will have to wrestle with, and that's whether or not we're going to, it's bullet three. Mm-hmm. If Oregon no longer covers the OHP standard population, what role should FEOC play? And I think that that's a very, very critical question that has to be answered by the legislative body, the policy decision as to whether or not FEOC will be will going to expand and work with the working individual, or which is who may earn more than 170% of poverty level. At the same time, where you have individuals who are under that level who need service, but who are not a part of the categorical eligibility class. And that's what we're doing. That's what we're wrestling with as a body.
You're very wise, because that's what I was thinking, and I just didn't eloquently say that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
I guess another way of looking at, and thank you, Madam Chair, of Representative Smith's question for me, is to say that if there are 243,000 uninsured people in the state who are eligible for this subsidy, how many of those people live in the two areas of the state that Representative Smith is raising questions about? What does that population look like contrasted to the actual number receiving a subsidy? The answer to that question would tell us something about, possibly tell us something about outreach and penetration rates with your outreach,
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I can provide you, and I don't have it here with me, we actually on a weekly basis lay out enrollment against population against uninsured population. Mm-hmm. We track that on a weekly basis. And it's actually that figure that is to us in some ways more important than just looking at the population. But we report that weekly through what we call the FEOP snapshot, looking at uninsured rates, enrollment rates, percentage of population.
I think, Madam Chair, follow-up, that level of detail would give this geographic distribution of enrolled members more meaning if you could provide that back to us.
Madam Chair, Senator Gorley will do that. We have that and should be able to get that to you tomorrow. We've collected, we've been collecting it since day one. You know, Madam Chair, let me talk to you a little bit about, because the question comes up sometimes, how many people we can serve, and I'm always asked that. When you talk about 220,000 or 150,000 between 100 and 200% of poverty. We're doing a study funded by the Robert Woods Foundation right now. We hope to finish it in May or June that will answer how many people have group coverage available to them, where are they, what industries do they work for, what's their wage structure, how old are they, do they have dependents, what kind of benefit plans, a variety of different questions. And Lewin and Associates has the contract, and they're out testing that product now, and we hope to do the survey in the next 30 to 60 days. Our guess is that, and it's a guess right now, there are between approximately 30 to 40,000 that probably have group coverage available to them out of that 150,000. The remaining don't. The remaining are people that work for the pizza parlors and the Dairy Queens of the world that don't provide group health insurance for their employee or the dependents. Our sense is that if you said, here's a blank check, go serve the people that don't have group coverage available, that I could pretty much fill up between 25 and 50,000 folks pretty quick. The legislature in 97 said we don't have enough money to do that, but as resources become available, we'll try to at least start that process and get the structure in place, and FEOP was the model. On the group side, I've got 11,000 openings today. Why aren't they full? Well, we suffer from the same thing that all state programs and government agencies and legislators and governors suffer from right now, and that's credibility and believability. When I sit down with an employer and say, we want to work with you to sign up some of your employees, right now, more often than not, the message I'm getting is so that you can enroll somebody for 2 months and then back out, leave me holding the bag. You don't have credibility, Rocky. What we're waiting for and the struggle we've had is somebody at some point is going to say the program's here or the program's not here. And when they say the program's here, then I can sit down with employers with some sense of credibility and say, sign them up because I'm here tomorrow. One of the things about group coverage, and some of you are in PEB, I assume, so you may know this, but open enrollment in October, you get in January. You enroll your spouse. In February, you can't decide not to enroll your spouse. You can only do that through open enrollment, unless there's a death, marriage, blah, blah, blah. The problem is you bring somebody in on a subsidy right now, and we cut this program out in 2 months. The employer is going to say, and I have to pick up the subsidy cost because they can't afford it, and the carrier won't let them out. So both employees who will be on the hook and employers have taken some risks, those that have come on board the last 3 months since we really started the waiver expansion. And there are a lot of them out there that are just waiting for the signal. Now, does that mean they're all going to come on at once? No. It takes a while to develop credibility and the relationships with the employer community. But we are doing that. And Bill Shonley, as we talked about early, is helping us do that because he's a good spokesman for us. But that's the biggest challenge we face in the group market is just the credibility of, is the state going to be behind us after we get people enrolled in this program? And we hope to have an answer for them in 3 months. We hope it's positive, but we know that there's bigger issues and some of the things that John's raised in his analysis that have to be addressed.
Senator Morris.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Looking at page 23, Rocky, the enrollment is 4,030 all markets. and the average subsidy is $177 per month. What's the cost to administrate that per person per month? Is there somewhere you could direct me to?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I believe that our objective is about 10% for the 2003-05 biennium. That's what we've listed as one of our performance measures. So your cost, we assume, is going to be in that $15 to $20 range. Now, if it's individual market, it's a lot cheaper because it's all electronic. If it's a group market, it's a little bit more labor-intensive because you're dealing with faxes and weekly reimbursements as opposed to just a premium billing system. But our objective and the performance measures we laid out is to get to 10%, and we're going to do our best to get there.
And part of that, realizing that 10% is where you're not constantly so static. Because if you're up one time and you're down next, it's kind of hard to get it.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, let me give you a real day-to-day example of that as an administrator. We developed space expansion for 25,000 if we were going to serve a part of the waiver, 25,000. If the governor's balanced budget says 15,000, and that's what we end up with, then I'm going to end up reducing my space. But I can't reduce it yet because what I can't afford is to give up and pay the penalties on a lease and then have somebody come in and add 7,000 in June. So there are a variety of things that impact that administrative. My administrative cost is up now because I'm holding on to some space until I know what the final budget is because I can't afford to give up the space until I know. It's just been very difficult to try to manage this, and we just look forward to having a period of time where it's open. We can prove that we can put the people on and don't have to close intake in some of the programs so we can develop a more stable administrative cost for us to be able to report to you.
You know, and we're not going to get finished today. I think we are enjoying your presentation, Rocky. So we will continue tomorrow.
Okay.
And with that, I'll see you tomorrow at 1, and we are adjourned.